Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. Healing is an active process. It's a journey, and there's no map. Your progress is at your own pace, and although you can learn from others, no one can guarantee where you'll end up. So it is with discovering what food to eat, what nutrients you need, and how to get them. There's tons of information out there, but how things work for you is individual. It's with this growing understanding that today's guest, Jessica Prentice, became a chef, author, and food activist. Her book, Full Moon Feast, is the most inclusive work on how to choose and prepare sustainable, healthy food I've seen. Join us as we explore finding community food resources and how to use your ancestors, for instance, to guide you in the preparation of food that will protect and nourish your soul. First, an editorial about recent health news. 2 weeks ago, the Associated Press reported on Italian research into cardiac rehabilitation. 89 men and 11 women suffering from heart failure at an average age of 59 were divided into three groups. One group had the usual supervised treadmill and cycling workouts three times a week. Another group had no exercise. And the third group, the most successful group, waltzed. They waltzed, some fast, some slow, for 21 minutes at a time, three times a week. Everything got better, including the usual scientific parameters like oxygen uptake and other measurements that predict fitness. They didn't just dance. They waltzed. Imagine the joy of gliding gracefully in the arms of another, twirling along in a giant circle. Do you think they forgot about everything else? Do you think they had a different relationship to their bodies, to their partners? Now this is great research. Leave it to the Italians to remind us that life can be gracious and good for you too. So, what does this mean for you? It means that just exercising works, but joy in movement and learning to be with others and having glorious good times is life. We're not just machines that need maintenance. Our hearts need company, music, and dance. So now back to our program with today, which is about sustainable eating and cooking. If you want to read a copy of this editorial, it will be posted on our blog, which is on our homepage, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Just click on the block that says blog. So our guest today, as I mentioned, is Jessica Prentice, P-R-E-N-T-I-C-E. She is both a professional chef and a passionate home cook. In her cooking, Jessica brings together creativity, imagination, and a deep respect for traditional cuisine and time-honored culinary practices. Through her work, she seeks to provide a model for how communities can feed themselves in a way that's satisfying and health-supportive on all levels. Delicious, environmentally responsible, and grounded in wise, nourishing traditions of our forebears. She writes a New Moon newsletter called Stirring the Cauldron that is sent out to internet subscribers around the world on each new moon. Recently, Jessica Prentice worked as the director of education programs at the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, where she conducted farm tours to some of Northern California's most ecologically oriented farms and ranches, taught live cooking demos, and hosted panel discussions around issues of sustainable agriculture and conducted regular interviews with farmers at the Saturday morning Ferry Plaza Farmers Market in San Francisco. Jessica is the former chef of the Headland Center for the Arts in Marin County, California. In 2001, she founded the Headlands Hearth Bakery and Cafe, a community dining hall in the Marin Headlands, featuring locally and sustainably grown foods home-cooked into delicious meals at an affordable price. She's a graduate of the Natural Gourmet Cookery School in New York from the nation's only professional chef's training program that focuses on food and health and natural foods. Jessica Prentice is a Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area chapter head for the Weston A. Price Foundation for Wise Traditions in Food Farming and the Healing Arts. And we're very honored to have you in studio today.
Thank you so much for having me, Lena.
You're very welcome. Make sure you're speaking right into the microphone so we get good volume on you.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Thanks. I think I wanted to start by asking you to tell us how discovering that you yourself, because this book is really not only about food and preparation of food and gathering food and health, it's also a kind of personal journey and an autobiography in a way. So tell us how discovering that you were developing, you know, a sort of eating disorder propelled you into learning how to use food to heal.
Wow. Well, as a teenager, I think I'm not so unusual as far as young women in this country go, that as a teenager, I became very sort of obsessive with food. And, you know, I was never diagnosed officially with anything, but I spent a good number of my teenage years just completely fixated on food and, you know, always worrying about it, worrying about what I had eaten, what I hadn't eaten, what I should eat, what I shouldn't eat. I became a vegetarian when I was 14 and sort of went from there to thinking, well, not only is meat bad, but fat's bad, salt's bad, sugar's bad. All these things are bad, and so really putting myself on a whole series of diets, the Pritikin diet, other diets, and, of course, simultaneously obsessing about my weight and my body and all those things that young women tend to get fixated on for a whole variety of reasons. And yet, I don't know, somehow my recovery ultimately became about I think part of what was so hard about those years was that not only was I obsessed with food, but I really thought that food was not an important thing. I had a big judgment about food. I thought that, you know, art was important, poetry was important, love was important, history was important, all kinds of things were important, but food wasn't. Food was a very mundane and I think maybe even selfish and sort of
it wasn't pure. That's what you talk about.
It wasn't spiritual. I didn't think it was a spiritual thing. And so compounded with my obsession with food that seemed unrelenting, I had this huge self-judgment. So then I was obsessed with being obsessed about food. And that went on for a number of years. And what's interesting is that this finally shifted in my life when I finally decided that food actually was very important and was spiritual and had to do with art and love and history and all of these other things that that I had judged to be important things. And it was almost like I finally said somewhere in my mid-20s to food, okay, you can have me. And I've sort of never looked back. Once I kind of jumped in, then food has been sort of the entranceway, the passageway into just a huge amount of learning and discovery in my life around health, around history, around all kinds of things. And so that was kind of an interesting process, as I finally had to stop fighting against food.
Well, one of the things you talk about right away in the book, and it threads through the book consistently, is this issue that you describe as letting go of being pure, mm-hmm. and sort of having the courage to become part of the food chain, because you were a vegan, and you had very strong feelings about how that was certainly made you more pure, and how much animal husbandry and whatnot was destructive to the environment and whatnot. And you talk a lot about, you posit this question a lot, can we raise food without the suffering and killing of creatures and animals?
Yeah, well, it's such a good way to put it, that it really was this struggle about purity. And so many of the early diets that I tried were really about trying to rise above the earth, trying to somehow, you know, levitate or something. And, you know, sort of the extreme of this kind of pursuit would be the quote-unquote breatharians who, you know, try to live on breath alone. But, I mean, I definitely was sort of along that path. But at the same time, it never worked for me, and I was always in a struggle. I never went down it very far, because there was also this part of me that was sensual and loved food and loved to eat and wanted to eat and was attracted to the things I thought were bad for me. So it was a real kind of tug of war inside my spirit between these two impulses.
In fact, you were getting very ill, too. I mean, you describe a whole raft of symptoms that I talk about on the show a lot that go along with people not having enough nurturance to sustain themselves, and they begin to crave sugar. And you were giving in to these binges with sugar, and then you developed sort of polycystic ovaries and symptoms of metabolic syndrome.
Absolutely. No, it wasn't working for my body. So there was this sort of tug of war going on in my spirit, but also I was trying to listen to my body, trying to heal myself. And that just complicated matters, too, because, you know, there's so much information out there. You'd read a book and it would say, oh, you know, don't eat this, don't eat that, you know, eat lots of soy, eat lots of seaweed, eat lots of grains, you know, that kind of thing. And so I would try all these things, and, you know, it was pretty alarming to find myself in my mid-20s having spent 10 years very, very focused on what I consider to be healthy eating and always trying to do better and very conscious and cooking for myself and all these things. And I was really ill. Mm-hmm. I was really ill. And so all of a sudden I had to kind of come up against myself and realize that my mind was not giving me all the information that I needed. And I needed to kind of sink down in my body into some other place and kind of try to get my mind out of the way a little bit and really listen to my body. And one of the things that, I mean, I got this information from two places, but I started to crave meat, even though I was a very committed vegetarian. And then also acupuncturists were telling me, you know, you need to start eating animal protein. And so those two things finally like broke through this identity that I had around this purism, the vegetarianism, the aspiring veganism, the macrobiotic aspirations, all of that. And then it was actually, frankly, listening to your show a few years ago when I heard an interview with Sally Fallon, and everything all of a sudden that I had experienced in my body, I started to understand. And then that opened up this whole new gateway into traditional foods.
Well, indeed, you've done a lot of research, and it's in your book. So I ask you, can we raise food without the suffering and killing of animals?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we can minimize suffering, but I don't think that there's a way for us to be a part of this earth without there being death. And some of that death is going to come from animals. And, you know, everything that lives a certain kind of life and dies a certain kind of death. We do too. It's a part of the picture. And I think the assumption that death is bad is one of the things I try to grapple with a little bit in my book, because I think it's a very Western, fearful kind of place to be coming from when it comes to death. And there's lots of other cultures that have looked at death as a transition and not as an ending and not as a bad thing and not as something that you can't laugh about and even, really express about, grieve about, but move through grief and just really embrace. And so I think part of my process has been about that, an evolution in my feeling about death and finally coming to accept that death was okay and was a part of the cycle. And then I mean, suffering is slightly a different issue. I don't think that there's any way that we can have life without suffering. I mean, we all know that. I mean, even when you enter into a relationship with somebody, you know, you're foolish to think that you might be able to have that relationship without causing that person suffering or them causing you suffering. I mean,
yeah,
it's
a big
just,
surprise.
It's part of the package. Yeah. So we can't completely get away from the suffering, but I do think that the factory farming system has really completely...
It's unnecessarily cruel.
It's unnecessarily
and
cruel.
And rapacious and
yes.
greedy and dangerous. It
and
is.
Unhealthy.
And unhealthy. But what's important here is that some of the things that you discuss in here, this is a very important issue because I sometimes get contacted by vegetarians, not a lot, but some vegetarians contact me and say, you're helping me to figure out how to make good choices. But occasionally I get one, you know, that's a animal rights person, and I'm an animal rights person as well, the thing is. And I have tried to explain to people that choosing to return to eating meat for me was an extremely emotional and very painful experience because I identify very closely with animals, and that's kind of a middle class advantage. People who are poorer don't have that advantage. And, you know, the truth is that when vegetables are raised, when I was living at Tassajara as a student, I was head of the garden for, I also learned to cook in the kitchen with various famous people, whose names I won't drop. But and I remember raising a bunch of vegetables from infancy, you know, from seed, and then planting the seedlings and guarding them. We had to trap gophers. We had to kill snails and insects. And some people who were gardening there did, in fact, occasionally, in the process of trapping gophers or moles or something, killed them. And this, of course, gets worse the bigger the farm is. And we were, of course, killing lots of other insects and things like that in the process. Here I babied these little plants. And then one day, you know, the kitchen sent an order for me to harvest a bunch of something. It was lettuces or something. And I had to go out there with a knife and chop them off at their roots. And I can't even begin to tell you how distraught I was. I mean, they're alive. Mm-hmm. So farmers have to kill animals all the time in order to raise vegetables. Cows consume a lot of small creatures when they're eating. They don't eat a strictly vegan diet. And you even bring up the fact that the Buddha, in the information that we have about him in his striving for the middle way, actually ate meat. Mm-hmm. And didn't tell people not to eat meat.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think you bring up a really important point, which I do talk about, which is that I think there are a number of people in urban areas, you know, sort of when you are a few generations removed from the farm and you live in an urban area, you can have this sort of illusion that there's a way to farm that doesn't involve killing animals. And that's just not true. Animals die in our farming of everything. So even if you're eating, you know, a strictly vegetarian diet, animals die so that you may eat. And there's even some controversy as to where more animals die, that more animals die in the farming of grains and beans than they do in the ranching of animals for meat. Of course, that meat's never eaten, and, I mean, you can, or, I mean, it's eaten by other creatures, but rarely by people. So you can sort of, you know, make a kind of spiritual evaluation of that one way or the other. I mean, would it be better once the animal is killed? You know, I have a friend who was a vegetarian for many years and was on an organic farming program, and the first meat he ate when he decided to start eating meat again was one of those gophers that he was killing every day in that program. And he just decided, you know, I'm killing these animals anyway. I'm going to try eating it. Well, you know, it was a lot of work and not much meat, but it was a spiritual practice for him to make use of that life. And I think one of the things that sort of irks me on a daily level driving around Berkeley is a bumper sticker you sometimes see that says, "Vegetarians save lives every day." And the evidence really doesn't bear that out. And so you have to understand, if you're choosing to be a vegetarian, that you're choosing it for a personal reason, and that you might not want, for a spiritual reason or for some other reason, to take the dead body of another animal into you. And I can really understand that.
Yeah,
but
me too.
But I think it's dangerous to have this illusion that somehow you're saving lives. That's not what the evidence shows, and it's a kind of ignorance that can only come from not being connected to farming and to the land and what actually is happening out there.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I also don't discourage vegetarians who are really healthy from being vegetarians. I just add some vitamins into their diet to help support them. But if someone comes in and they're not healthy as a vegetarian, then I warn them off of it. So for me, it's an issue of just looking at your health and what do you actually need to sustain yourself. And then I would just ask people, just as I don't want people to impress their religious beliefs on me, that they give me a break and let me have the space and other people to have that journey themselves and discover what works on an individual basis, and know that what works for you may not work for someone else. I want to read a passage from your book that talks about this, because I thought it described this situation really well. When you see everything around you, animal, vegetable, mineral, as imbued with spirit, as alive and sentient, as carrying with it a crucial part of the whole, when you view all of life as inextricably interconnected by a thread, a spark of something divine, you understand that the great beautiful creation involves death and decay just as certainly as it involves birth and resurrection. Everything is indebted to everything else. Every part of creation is indebted for its life to the other parts of creation that have died and decayed so that it might live. So I appreciate that, and thank you for writing that. Very briefly, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. In studio is Jessica Prentice, P-R-E-N-T-I-C-E. Her book is called Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. It is both autobiographical. It talks about research. It talks about Weston A. Price. It talks about traditional cooking methods. It talks about community and sustainable eating, and it has recipes as well. When you were reading Weston A. Price, it sort of taught you about the health effects of food, and not to grind this today. I mean, not to, you know, sort of overdo this so that people turn off their brains while they're listening to the show if they're vegetarians. But Weston A. Price, of course, was this dentist who studied the cultures of the world, looking to see how native diet affected people's health and what happened when they moved away from a native diet. What you said in the book I didn't realize, which is that he never found a healthy vegan culture.
Mm-hmm. And he went looking. I mean, he was hoping to find one, and he went to a particular island in the South Pacific that he thought was big enough that he had heard that there were inland people that didn't eat seafoods and that this island didn't have very many land animals. And so he thought that the peoples that were in the interior were quite likely to be people that subsisted completely on vegetable foods. And he went to this island and hired a guide, and the guide took him into the interior. And as far into the island as he got, he never stopped seeing these piles of seashells. And in fact, when he talked to the communities in the interior, what they said was that they knew from time immemorial, had been passed down, that they had to eat seafood at least once every 3 months to be healthy. And I mean, the majority of their diet was vegetable foods, but they ate these seafoods with a great deal of intention. And one of the most interesting aspects of this story is that they were often at war with the coastal people. And yet, even in the times of war, there were particular spots, caches, where they would go and they would leave some of the choice mountainous inland foods for the coastal people, and the coastal people would leave the seafoods for them. So there was sort of this peace treaty around these foods. So even when they were maybe killing each other in other ways, they had this understanding, and people transporting these foods were never disturbed by the warriors. And it was very deeply understood on that island that it was important that the seafoods got into the interior, and that was sort of his great hope for finding a diet that didn't involve any animal foods, but it didn't turn out to be so.
It's interesting that I talk to people who tell me that they are vegetarian, but they eat fish.
Mm-hmm.
You comment on it in the book,
mm-hmm.
too. I always find this puzzling. Why? Because I remember snorkeling in the Caribbean and then going to the market in the morning to go buy some food for the day, and seeing these tropical fish laying out for sale for eating, and I actually had tears in my eyes, and the people selling them were laughing at me. They thought I was ridiculous, you know. So I when I go to the Monterey Aquarium and I see the shrimp, I burst into tears. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't. For me, eating this stuff doesn't mean that I get away with it on an emotional level. I feel it. I still feel that,
And I think that's so important. I think it's so important to feel it. And I think this is part of the point of my book, that you can do both. You can feel it. You can acknowledge it. And you can eat it. You can feel the sorrow. You can weep. You can relate. You can hold all of that at the same time without rising above it. And part of why you weep is because you're right in there with it. And that's the way that traditional peoples lived. I mean, part of the problem, I think a lot of the impulse to become vegetarian, and this was certainly true for me, has to do with the fact that we don't acknowledge that cycle of life and death.
Nope.
We don't see it. Yeah. We want our beef to be, you know, in a patty between two buns, and you know, we don't like to even see the bones, we don't like to see the heads, we don't like to see the feet, we don't like to see the death, we don't want to know where it happens. We don't want to have that consciousness, and that is what I think is the problem. The problem is the lack of consciousness, and once you get conscious, it becomes very hard to eat factory farmed meat. Because I can't do it.
I can, you know, but I, on the other hand, I don't think I'd ever be up to killing an animal on my own. I mean, some people can do it, some people can't. But that doesn't mean I don't think people, I can't fathom it. But there are famous food taboos, and they arose what people say about eating meat is that I can hear them, you know, I can hear the voices in the background saying, well, just there's all this petroleum used to produce beef, you know, it gets shipped here and there. And what we're talking about on the air today is that no matter where you live in the United States or wherever else you live, there is, you can connect with locally grown meat sources and chicken and eggs and milk and all these things and vegetables can be purchased. They're all over the country. You don't have to live on the West Coast to have fresh food. There's food everywhere. I guess unless you're living someplace really extreme like Alaska. Even Alaska and Antarctica, I suppose.
Yep.
Food store, yeah. Stuff there. But there's these famous food taboos that came up, like don't eat this, don't eat that. And you talk a little bit about how those arose and the fact that they're not, people have taken them very to heart in modern society, and most of them are not valid reasons for not eating things anymore, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have taboos per se, but we have, they've kind of evolved into distastes. And like I said, I mean, almost anything that looks like the animal that it is hard for us. And, you know, it's interesting because different, you know, there's cultures that eat, you know, snails and lots of shrimp, you know, whole and, chicken feet and all these kinds of things. But there are also cultures that believe that to eat a plate of shrimp is a terrible thing because it's not just one life that died, it's 10 little lives that died for your for your one meal.
If it's salad shrimp,
it's a lot more than that. So, you know, in Tibet, there's a strong sense that you kill a large animal, you give thanks, and then you share it, and then one life is lost, but 100 people are fed. But all throughout West Africa, they, you know, the tiny shrimp are a major part of the diet. And so, I mean, some of these things, I think, have to do with the ecology of the place where the diet developed, and the spirituality rises out of what people needed to live. But it's all very interesting to me to explore these kinds of traditions and these taboos.
Well, and if you watch any nature program where they're showing a whale hoovering down a bunch of krill, and then you see close-ups of the krill, you know, and they're these beautiful translucent little guys, you know, with these little black eyes, and they're just they're just vacuuming them down, you know, and we love the whales. Before we go to break, you discuss some very interesting examples of sustainable animal husbandry and the way in which animals on a farm a kind of work. And the example that I'm thinking of is the mixing of chickens and cattle, rotating the land. Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe that?
Yeah, well, it's. I mean, the point that not only vegetarians, but I would certainly make about feeding grain to cows and, you know, the use of the misuse of energy and calories that's involved in that is absolutely valid. But it's important to remember that, you know, feeding grain to cows is an extremely recent phenomenon, and that cattle developed, you know, people became pastoralist and herded cattle in all kinds of landscapes, but particularly in landscapes where there was a lot of access to pasture. And it was an incredibly elegant strategy for feeding the community because you can't, as a human being, eat grass. And yet there's lots of land out there that is better, much better suited to being biodiverse polyculture of grasses than it is to being a place where you grow crops, grains, or otherwise.
No, that's very important. I hope people heard you, that the type of land that cows graze on is not the same as what you would grow crops on.
Right. So there's this either-or mentality that's just, that again, to a subsistence kind of society, that would be absurd. They would look at you like you were crazy. Like, no, we have a certain amount of land that makes sense to grow crops on and a certain amount that's pasture. I mean, you know, really steep mountainous areas, you know, that's where people started farming goats because it's perfect, you know, and then you get the meat, you get the dairy products from that and so forth. But the particular example that you're bringing up is the fact that in these places where ruminant animals graze, and cows are a ruminant animal, and that means that they have a rumens and that they are perfectly evolved to digest grass, you often would see ruminant animals followed by birds. And the birds, you know, wild birds, this is in the wild even, the birds perform a very important set of functions, one of which is that they actually peck through the manure and they eat all the little larvae that are in there, thereby sanitizing it, breaking the life cycle of the flies that can actually be, you know, very disruptive to the ruminant. And they also break that cow patty up so that the nutrients recycle in a way that's healthy for the pasture and then feed the grasses. So having ruminants on grasses actually does a number of really good things. It promotes biodiversity. If you don't graze a piece of pasture at all, one and usually an introduced species, but one species will tend to take over. And the grazing actually promotes more different kinds of grasses growing on that. It creates a better polyculture in that pasture. And then if you have the birds following, then they're helping the fertilization, because actually those very condensed cow pies, if they go down into the soil, they create these sort of little pockets that are too nitrogen rich, and it's actually not good for the pasture. So, but then also, you know, one of the main things that we do with our cattle is we deworm them, and that becomes completely unnecessary when you have chickens, for example. The way people have applied this in modern farming is to graze cows on a certain piece of land, then move them out, and then bring their chickens behind. And the chickens break up the cow pies, they eat the fly larvae, they break the life cycle of these of the pests that bother the cattle, and then there's no need to give these insecticides, basically these poisons, to the cows, because the chickens have done this work, and then the pasture is fed, and then after a certain period of time, the pasture is growing up again and beautifully glorious, and then you bring the cows back on, and you build this incredible ecosystem.
Yes, yes, you do. We've got to take a brief break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jessica Prentice, Prentice. Full Moon Feast is her book. We're going to take a brief musical break and come right back to our interview. Stay with us.
We are meat. We are spirit. We have blood, and we have grace. We have a will, and we have muscle, a soul, and a face. Why must we die? We have eyes, an intuition, a DNA code, and a name. Something to logic, some superstition. We have an aura and a frame. Kings. Why
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with author of Full Moon Feast, Jessica Prentice, P-R-E-N-T-I-C-E. Her book is published by Chelsea Green. She has a couple of websites. I'll have her give those out in a moment. If you miss parts of today's show, you can go to our website and listen to it all week long at yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer, news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, and you can find out how to get a copy of this or any other in the series, or you can call us at 707-874-2772 is the general number. You can reach Dr. Jeff Fawcett at 707-874-1496. And Jessica, your websites are?
My base website is Wise Food Ways, WiseFoodWays.com. And the place that I'm at the most now is I've started a business here in Berkeley. It's a community-supportive kitchen where we make nutrient-dense foods based on traditional recipes using local and sustainable ingredients and lots of grass-fed, pastured animal products. And that is www.threestonehearth.com. And I'll spell it. It's three, T-H-R-E-E, like the number, stone, S-T-O-N-E, like a rock, hearth, H-E-A-R-T-H, like a fireplace, .com. And lots of Bay Area people are buying our food, and that's going really well. And then, you know, I'm also a big advocate for eating locally, and so I've got two projects that I'm working on with that. I've got a local foods wheel, which is just localfoodswheel.com. And also an Eat Local Challenge. We pick a different month each year and try to encourage people to eat locally, and that's locavores.com, L-O-C-A-V as in Victor, O-R-E-S.com.
We'll try to get all those on our website as
yeah.
well. You know, it was very interesting to one of the things about your book that I found interesting is how inclusive it is, because given your proclivity toward looking at our history with food and examining how people ate, you know, going back to the hunter-gatherers, you still include information on fermented alcoholic beverages, which are actually lacto-fermented, and we'll talk about those in a minute. You include information on grains and corn, and you even have some recipes with some forms of sugar. And you know, my experience is that people vary in terms of how and when and whether they can touch any of those things. And that's why at the beginning of the show, I made a point of saying to people, it's your journey. You can gather information, but only you can sense whether or not you can tolerate these various things. But what Jessica does in this book that's valuable is give you some principles to follow if you're going to use these foods in a healthful way. So one of the things I was charmed by was reading about Jared Diamond's research where he discusses the hunter-gatherer cultures and says something that I've actually, without having read his research, have said on the air myself, which is that the only thing that a agrarian or agriculturally based culture did when it introduced grains was give us a slave class. Do you want to comment on his research?
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting to think about this historically, and I think there's definitely some links there. I do also try to point out that Weston Price studied a couple of cultures that were grain-based, that were very egalitarian, and also for those people who know Helena Norberg Hodge's work, Ancient Futures, she discusses a culture that is that also eats grain but is very egalitarian. And what I think is interesting about those sort of exceptions to the rule is that there was also a very pastoralist base. I think that the culture was more pastoralist, and then grain kind of became something that supplemented the meat and the dairy products that were coming from the animals. But animal husbandry was very central in both the Swiss alpine culture that that Price studied, and also in Hodge's studies of Ladakh. So I'm interested, you know, it's like...
Are you going to hang me out to dry after I made that comment? You're just going to leave me blowing in the wind here? Am I going to have to defend my
stance? I mean, I think it's... I I mean,
I agree with you that it's not black and white, but what I was trying to point out and what he discusses in his research is that when you look back through the fossil record, what you see is that with the introduction of grain, which enabled a lot of people to be fed cheaply and to keep weight on people so that they wouldn't starve to death, what you saw, and I'm talking going way back to early cultures where you first begin to see this, like in Egypt and early Western Indian cultures, is that the cultures split into a working class and a ruling class, and the ruling class was eating meat and the slave class was eating grain, and you can tell from the fossils that are left that that's so. And of course the meat eaters are taller and the grain eaters are smaller, and so there was this sort of nastiness. All I was trying to point out is that when people extol the growing and eating of beans and grains and agriculture as a way to stop hunger in the world and to take care of every kind of world problem that we can possibly have because of the economics of the situation, I might add that we're presuming that that it's good for the earth that human beings are reproducing and continuing to take over like we are, and that that's a good idea for the balance of the earth, that that's a healthy thing, because that's what grain culture allowed them to do. But as you say, there are cultures that used grains in a healthy way and didn't suppress other peoples as a result of the culture.
Yeah, and I think the point is important that, and that's exactly partly why I brought it up, is there is this assumption of in the minds of people who think about food and hunger that that grains are the great answer, that and that grains are this great sort of, you know, egalitarian, you know, inexpensive food that we can all eat. Well, I mean, I definitely think the research bears out that there was a drop in health in the movement from hunter-gatherer to agricultural. The tooth records, the dental records certainly show that. And, you know, it's just absolutely true that, that grains are not as nutrient-dense as the foods that hunter-gatherers were eating. And it took us a while, too, to figure out how to process grains in a way to get the, you know, as many of the good nutrients out of them as we could. And that I do think that it's really part of what I grapple with in that chapter is, well, just like you say, I mean, this whole grain-based farming and economy has gone hand in hand with this population explosion. And, you know, I mean, I think there's certainly a case to be made that, you know, the earth would be better off if humans lived in, you know, smaller groupings of hunter-gatherers. But then there's also kind of the reality that, I mean, and I don't think that...
We're not going back.
We're not going back.
But we can learn within this, you know, what we know to try. And that's, you know, what your work is about, is how do you get people sort of tapped back into a healthy groove so that we are living lightly on the earth. And it isn't just this black and white, oh, well, stop eating meat, or, you know, it's about this business of supporting food systems around you.
Right. Well, I think part of the point of my book is that it's not just about calories. It's not enough just to, I mean, we have to look at what human beings need and what the earth has to provide in a sort of, we need to, in, you know, what I would love to see is kind of an audit of the ecological resources of the earth. I mean, what
Thank
really
you.
do we have? I mean, right. Let's look at the seafood. Let's look at the oceans. Let's look at the mountains. Let's look at, you know, what should be rainforest and what should be pasture. And I mean, it's not that I think we should be cutting down rainforest and putting cattle on there.
Well, absolutely don't.
We're mostly growing
soybeans. Yeah.
You know, but soy is even worse.
Yes,
and
it is.
And so it's not just about, you know, that's a very sort of shallow and, you know, it's just not a deep enough way of looking at the problem.
Would that it was that simple.
I know.
Yeah.
Would that
Wouldn't
it was that,
that
simple.
Nice?
And that's why I felt like I had to tell my story, because I really operated under that assumption for a number of years. And it didn't work for me. And yet, you know, even in wealthy United States, middle class, you know, culture where I have general amount of access to stuff, I mean, I really think there's a number of people in this country who are malnourished.
Oh, yes.
Despite being, you know, their bellies being full every night, they're not actually truly being nourished. And right. I mean, of course, the processed foods are the hugest part of this problem. But even if we get sort of beyond that, then we have to really look at what is truly a diet that can, and of course it's going to be different for every person, but, you know, we kind of want to look at the macro and the micro. And one of the things that I think we can learn from traditional peoples is that when they took the life of an animal, they used the whole animal. They didn't, there was no such thing as the boneless, skinless chicken breast on a styrofoam, you know, plate in the platter in the grocery store. I mean, the bones were used for broth, which were made into soup. The, you know, the feet were put in there. The organ, the liver was made into mm-hmm. pate. Mm-hmm. Every part of that animal was used. And I think it is part of the problem that, you know, we do have a culture that, you know, just only sort of understands kind of like a meat and potatoes kind of approach to food.
You talk about a national eating disorder, which I agree, because people are horribly addicted to the problem with grains is the allergenic qualities that they have in the anti-nutrients and the fact that the more processed they are, the more poisonous they are. So while some people can eat whole grains cooked in porridges and whole grains, some people can, some people can't. People will have to discover who they are themselves. But the problem is that everything is so highly processed that everybody is craving sugar and binging. It's just terrible, and it's just blowing out everybody's endocrine system.
Yeah, no, it's very terrible, and I do make a point of saying in my book that I do believe that certain people have to just go back to a hunter-gatherer kind of approach.
Oh, most of the people who come to see me are way.
We lived much longer on the planet with those foods, they're much more, we're more evolved to digest them. And so, I mean, for a lot of people, it can be incredibly healing to get completely off of all
grains,
those grains. Yeah.
So just briefly, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm in the studio with Jessica Prentice, Prentice, Full Moon Feast. She has about 40,000 websites, which we will post on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, instead of giving them all out. But the book is available now. One of the ways to make grains less toxic and more healthful, again, for people who can handle things that are lacto-fermented, meaning they're not allergic to dairy, fermented beverages, which even have a little alcohol in them. But this is what the intention was of these foods initially, was not to just, well, who knows, maybe it was to just party, but it was also a healthful way to preserve grains and make them easier to digest.
Yeah, and I think that there were two different sort of developments. Traditional peoples definitely were interested in alcoholic fermentation and also discovering plants that would be psychoactive or, you know, change consciousness. And so in my Mead Moon chapter, I kind of talk about that. Why do human beings sort of seek that out and create that in cultures, this opportunity to get drunk sort of thing, but always in a religious context in traditional cultures. But then there's also, I consider soft drinks to be kind of the toxic mimics of these traditional nourishing
fermented
beverages
mm-hmm.
that were fermented with right. with an aim towards increasing nutrition, not towards getting drunk. And I think when we hear about our ancestors drinking beer for breakfast, for lunch out in the fields and for dinner, what we don't realize is that beer was not as alcoholic as the beer that we know. And it had all these electrolytes. I mean, basically, it was also the precursor to the sports drinks that are out there.
Well, not really. Not sports drinks. No, because sports drinks are just corn syrup and
right.
salt. But they do have. But well, water has electrolytes, but beer does have electrolytes. It also has a diuretic in it. So you drink and you urinate, and you drink and you urinate. But these were foods that were created to make it easier to absorb the nutrients from the grains, and they were also preserved so that they would last for a long time. So you had liquid
right.
bread, basically.
Yeah, and they were a whole range from thinner to thicker, and
mm-hmm.
and digestive, active
mm-hmm.
digestive enzymes,
mm-hmm.
And nourishing in and of themselves. And you know, one culture that I read about in South America, an Amazonian culture. They pretty much only eat meat and some, you know, they hunt and they eat meat and they eat some fresh fruits and so forth. But they ferment a root and they drink about a gallon of that a day. And it's their primary source of carbohydrates and also calories. It's a huge part of their diet is this fermented root drink. It's not made from grains. It's made from a root. But there were a lot of people throughout the world that developed these traditions of something beer-like, something, some kind of liquid bread, some kind of, and then all the way down to a thin, just really refreshing kind of root beer or ginger ale type of thing that was not corn syrup, not just carbon, bubbliness put into it, but was actually fermented to get some of that fizz.
And again, when people pick up this book and they start looking at the recipes, you know who you are. You know those of you who can eat grains and those of you who can't. You know those of you who can have small amounts of sugar and stop, and those of you who have a little bit of honey and then crave sugar all day and binge. So you have to go forward your own way, what you know about yourself. Now, before we completely run out of time, I want to talk about eating seasonally, because most people just throw their hands in the air and give up. I mean, they just can't even think how to do this. And obviously, examples are, as we were just saying, that you can, there are foods that are seasonal that store well, and there are foods that you can put up in a fermented way. You can can things and ferment them for the winter so that you don't go hungry. Even those people who are not as lucky as we are to live in a place where agriculture goes on all the time, you don't actually have to have mangoes from Mexico in the middle of winter. That said, you also said to me that eating seasonally and eating locally, but occasionally you have to know when to give up and go buy something imported. And when does that happen?
Well, I believe that our diet should be based on the bulk of what we eat should come from the place where we live and the ecosystem where we live and what makes sense in that ecosystem. And then imported foods supplement that. You know, they're certainly, I think part of what disturbs me about the globalization of our food system is that we no longer, first of all, it completely takes us out of the context of relationship. We don't know who grows our food. We don't know where it's grown. We don't know how it grows. We don't know what the plant looks like that it comes from. It's very anonymous kind of food system. But the other aspect is that we don't really have any sense that something, you know, that travels from a far distance is something sort of precious, you know, that is worth transporting. And that's what, you know, even a couple of hundred years ago, people had that sense. Or if you go back and read the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, and, you know, if you got an orange for Christmas, there was this amazing, oh my God, you know, this is an orange, and, you know, that that came from somewhere. Or whereas here, you know, you go to the grocery store and you're just as likely, if you buy an apple, that it's coming from New Zealand as that it's coming from Sebastopol. And that's really, to me, the insanity of the globalization. So
that said, of course, humans, as soon as they possibly could, I mean, very, very early on, they started trading things. You know,
yes.
So spices came from other places and coffee came from other places and all that nonsense. But so there's a place for that. And I note that with the push towards sustainability, there are now companies marketing things like teas and coffees, where you do have a better sense of what's going on these farms, or not farms, but plantations, because they are sustainable and there is a relationship with the workers. That's fair trade stuff. So
it's so important. And so I'm not interested in being pure. I spent enough of the early
Thank
part
you.
Of my life on
no
that
food jail.
Thing. No food jail. I'm not interested in saying no, really, to anything. I'm interested in saying yes to the things that I feel really nourish me. And so the things that I can get locally and in season, I do. And not only that, but I try to buy them directly from the farmer and put my dollar right into that farmer's hand.
And that's happening increasingly all over the country all year long.
Yes, absolutely.
So before you go, some cooking tips for people who are overwhelmed, because everybody tells me they do not have time to cook. Now, this is really ironic, because most of the foods they're cooking that they're putting in a microwave and damaging the protein and destroying the food are things that they could have cooked in about 10 minutes in a pan. So I try to help people with that when I can. But particularly, we're heading into a holiday season where people are cooking. So Do you want to give us both a few quick tips for cooking tips for people who are overwhelmed and think they have no time? I want to remind people we do have freezers. And could you also address cooking the turkey without turning the white meat into powder?
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, if part of the problem with this cooking thing is that people don't have the basic skills. And once you have the basic skills, you actually find that it's easier to cook something at home than it is to go out and get carry out or, you know.
Faster.
It's faster and easier. I'm really at that point. One of my very favorite things to do year round for a very quick meal is to make a frittata. Just because it's so easy, you can use whatever vegetables are seasonal. And this is basically sort of a baked egg pie without a crust. There's no grains in it. And, you know, you can saute some onions or leeks in some butter in an oven-proof pan. And then whatever vegetables you like that are seasonal, broccoli, asparagus in spring, corn or peppers in summer, zucchini, summer squash at this time of year, you could put any of the fall sort of squashes in there. You might want to cook them first. And then you basically just whip some eggs. If you can tolerate dairy, you can put some cream in there and salt and pepper. You pour that into the pan over your saute of vegetables and stick it in the oven about 300 degrees until it sets. And
how long does it take?
It depends on the size of the pan, but it can be as fast as under 10 minutes if it's a nice small pan.
That's
and
fast.
You're just doing it for one or two people. Or sometimes if it's thin enough, you can just stick it under the broiler and that'll finish the top off. And I love to make that and then have that with either a salad or sometimes some roasted potatoes or something like that. And that's just a really fast, easy thing that I do at least once a week because it's nourishing. It feels, it's a nice hot meal and I can get, really good pastured eggs that I feel great about, mm-hmm. that I find very, nourishing and satisfying on every level. And it's something that you can eat locally all year round.
Mm-hmm. Turkey before we run out of
time. There's always the brining thing. The brining comes in. I mean, part of the reason that the white meat tastes like sawdust is that these turkeys are overbred and they're...
Not the ones we're buying, though, because we're all buying these...
The heritage ones.
We can't all get heritage ones. You can't.
Ones,
they
right.
run out immediately, but you can get organic turkeys mm-hmm. in California anyway, and I think you can get them on other parts of the country. But
yes, you can, and they are still usually coming from breeds that have been bred to have very, very large breasts, and that, you know...
This is America.
I know. a saltwater brine, it can for the dryness problem, that's probably the safest thing. And then I like to roast my turkey at a very high temperature. Roast it fast and high.
Oh.
I do think that the lower temperature tends to dry out the
What's
meat
What's the temperature?
More. Like
10, 12?
Like 500, like 450,
oh
500.
Oh, my God.
Like really, really, really pretty hot. And
wow, we're going to try that.
Yeah, give it a try.
We're going to try
and
it.
You can brine it first if you really want more moisture in there, and that can also lend some really nice flavor.
Wish we had time to describe the brine, but we don't.
There are lots of websites that have that.
Okay, look on the websites. And your websites, Jessica Prentice, Prentice, Full Moon Feast, will be posted on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. And I, 9 Bows. I mean, this is a great book, kiddo. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for all your work over the years.
You do
such a good job.
Back at you. Okay, bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772, or you can reach Jeff Fawcett, editor of the Progressive Health Observer and health educator, at 707-874-1496. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, transcripts, or the Progressive Health Observer, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen to this week's show all week, along with usually an archive that's up there for a few weeks. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.